Text 51551. Today with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, last year, 400 Irish families joined the thousands of others who have lost someone as a result of suicide. It is, without doubt, one of the most painful and challenging tragedies to affect any family, with friends and loved ones often uncertain how best to offer support or even know what to say. Well, here to help us navigate through this deeply personal subject is Professor Jim Lucy, Medical Director of St Patrick's University Hospital, and he's also Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at TCT. Thanks for coming in, Jim.
Good morning, Mary.
Look, it's still such a sensitive subject, isn't it? One that thousands of people have had to face.
It always will be. This is a very special form of grief, a very special form of bereavement. And before we go any further, we have to acknowledge that, you know, this is perhaps the most sensitive topic we've ever talked about on this. We've been doing these broadcasts for nearly 12 years now. And of all the topics we've covered, this must be the most sensitive, I think. Yeah. And it's important because, as you say, 400 families this year have experienced this. Practically every one of us in the country knows someone who's died by suicide. And many of us have had someone who was close in family or friend. And we know the exquisite and particular grief that this involves.
I mean, tell us about the grieving process. I mean, is it different for people who lose a loved one to suicide than, say, losing someone to cancer? Is it a different grieving process?
So it's the same and more. So grief is a universal experience. We will all be bereaved. It's a painful experience. It's one that can take many, many months before we get from the acute grief process to an integrated grief where one carries on and is able to live and work and love again. But in terms of a grief after suicide, you have all the added pain of any sudden and catastrophic death, which adds to grief, and then another element of it, which is what we might call the suicide grief factor. And that's a grief factor that comes from the very nature of suicide, which, of course, raises whole sets of questions for the bereaved who must carry on and who struggle to understand and will ask themselves questions as to about what this all meant. We'll want, perhaps, and the Irish research is interesting on this, there's some great need for greater research in this area, but there is an interesting small study which I've quoted in the blog, which I'd recommend people to read, which looks at the four stages. Now, I don't want to suggest to anybody that there's a normative process or a set number of stages one must go through. But certainly in the Irish research, there's four patterns. So at the initial phase, there's a tremendous need or desire to control the events. And this is characteristic, I think. I've seen this in my
work. What do you mean
by
that?
Well, the behaviour involves such panic, such shock, that the first response is to try and control everything. There may be a temptation to limit the actual discussion of the word, to even say what has happened. The second is, and that can go on for a long time, but the second, if you like, phase might be, according to Begley's research, would be a tremendous sense of desire to make sense of it. Mm. What happened? How could this have happened? And that can go on for a tremendous amount of time. And again, suicide grief is longer than even acute catastrophic grief or what we might call universal grief. And then there's a third phase, which seems to be a persistent sense of social dis-ease or unease. An alertness, a bewilderment, an exquisite sort of being lost. Hopefully and eventually people come to the integrated sense at the end of this where they can value the loved one, value the life. Everything we say today should really be an attempt to do two things, to respect those who've died and support those who must carry on. And hopefully in that fourth phase, we can get to a point where we can integrate as we do our loved ones in every case of our lives, hopefully. Now, 20% of grief anyway finds integration very difficult. And enduring or what we call complicated grief happens 1 in 5 times. And it happens more frequently with suicide.
Because I suppose, is the big difference between a suicide and another death for a loved one that you'd end up feeling, is there anything more I could have done? That, in other words, if someone has a terminal diagnosis and they die of cancer and you've done everything you can, got every doctor on the planet, but if someone takes their own life by suicide, I think you'd end up feeling guilty, thinking, could I have done more to stop that?
So guilt is a huge problem, sometimes mitigated a little bit by a letter, some kind of understanding, but many of these deaths, we have 400, if you like, north of 400 that are recognised as suicide. It's probably more. It's probably an under figure. But many of even those 400, it's decided at a coroner's hearing. So along with that guilt and that bewilderment, that searching for sense and understanding, why did it happen? It's not like the cancer in one's eyes. Because mental illness has a greater morbidity than cancer. Let's be quite clear. Mental illness is the big factor here. 90% of deaths through suicide are preceded by mental disorder. And that's something that sometimes can come as a comfort, and then sometimes adds to the bewilderment and the sense of isolation, which this social disease I describe is a feature of, because people again feel stigmatised and unable to acknowledge and acknowledge themselves, or feel relieved of themselves because of that. And then I mentioned the coroner. While acute and sudden catastrophic deaths will go to a coroner and others in certain circumstances according to the law, every suicide case must be determined at a coroner. And so that's a prolonged process of investigation, of a very necessary process, and done, I think, in my experience, tremendously compassionately as often as possible by coroners. They're wonderful. But on the other hand, there's always this sense that something new will come out, some revelation, some understanding that wasn't there before. That can be a beneficent thing, or it can be a traumatic thing. And in between that, the guards have come. The ambulance came and removed the scene. The whole setting is different, and the prolonged context of it is quite unlike any other death.
You mentioned stigma there. There's less of a stigma, do you think, that, Jim? And also, I went to the funeral recently of a colleague, actually, who had lost a loved member of their family through suicide, and they were really open from the beginning about it, and I felt that was easier for everyone else. So everyone was really open. This person had taken their own life, so I wasn't afraid to talk about it. I mean, what are people meant to do?
Well, I mean, it's one of the things that psychiatry should never do, and certainly I wouldn't want to do, is to tell people what they should do. What we're describing here are patterns, and certainly where openness and, if you like, acceptance and a demonstrative love is apparent, that does make things less difficult. None of this is going to be easy. Let's not pretend. We can't be sort of facile about it. But there is a stigma. I mean, the world of commitment and if you like, striving for improvement in many respects that you occupy and I understand, you might feel stigma is diminishing. But I don't think that our talk alone is getting to the picture, because stigma is about many other factors. It's about the sense of personal labelling and of isolation and bewilderment. And it's deeply feared still. It's still not gone away. Now, the stigma about suicide, I certainly feel that the pain of suicide is going to be mitigated sooner by an openness that you describe. Yeah. But families invariably have pain in them, and this invariably, I think, puts a great deal of pressure on families. The people in the suicide start in the bereavement process will blame themselves, will blame others, will blame others within the family. There'll be counter-blame, and this is not helped by a feeling, understandable feeling, that maybe we could control this. There may be media involved. There may be a very public experience of discovery, and so the desire to control is about a very natural human way of trying to mitigate this.
So what's the most sensitive way, Jim, to comfort someone who has lost a loved one through suicide? What should we do?
Again, I think that there's an important thing to understand here. Someone has died and someone is bereaved. What would we do anyway in the context of a death? We'd be there. I think it's important to be there, to stay close to the bereaved. I think that the fact that the suicide is apparent or not apparent, it doesn't allow one to ask questions. You don't interrogate the bereaved. You be there. It may be necessary simply to sit and wait. It may be reasonable, and I think it is reasonable, to say, what can I do practically to help? Is there anything I could help? Is there anything I can say to you? In fact, you'll be asked for explanations. Don't give any. You'll be asked for, you'll be tempted to give explanations. Don't give any. Mm. What you can say is, I'm here. One of the key things to realise is that complicated grief, and this is complicated grief very frequently, is going to last longer. So be there and then make a commitment to be there for longer. When this is not a bad flu. The painful recollections and anniversaries and birthdays in all bereavements are all the more painful and long-standing. Be there and be there for the birthday. Now, you can ask the question, how would you like to talk about it? The bereaved are quite well able to say, yes, I do, or no, I don't. Now, ask the question. I would say...
Do ask the question.
Be there. And why wouldn't you be there? Because the isolation and the bewilderment and the stigma and the guilt and the remorse are all mitigated by human connection, by warmth, by the sincerity of that which is long-lasting, and by the commitment to recognise that the person who died did more than just end their lives. Mm. They lived it during it. Remember that life for the life that was, all the good and rich things that happened in it. And all
That's
the people,
a lovely way of putting it, actually. I think it might be of comfort even, I'm conscious, put somebody listening to us, Jim. Could have lost someone through suicide.
I'm very conscious of it, Miriam,
yeah.
That the people listening to this broadcast are the bereaved.
Mm.
And in my work, and in our work in mental health, in Patrick's and everywhere else, this is our daily consciousness. We see no one without this consciousness. And it's important for us to be aware that this is now something that's in our society. You're right. It's better that it's in the open. But it's not better that we sort of normative it, pretend it didn't happen, suggest that we're not going to measure it, or suggest that somehow, you know, it's all just moved, we'll all move on. You can't pretend and improve. You have to be authentic in order to improve. And the authentic improvement is to say, would you like to talk about it? And then there's practical things. The school runs the next day. There's a dog to be walked. There are errands to be run. What about saying, regardless of the cause of death, can I help in any practical way? And then be prepared to do it next week and next month. And if somebody says, you know, I don't want to, I just want to be alone, say, can I sit with you? Somebody might say, I want to pray. Can you pray with them? Can you say, somebody who has no faith, I respect that and be with that. Mm. The point about it is about the authentic staying with it. Now, many people say, I can't be doing with this. I'm not able for this. But we'll all be bereaved. And this is a bereavement that is more than the universal grief we have. But it's something about our bondedness to ourselves as a community. I think it's one of the great things in Ireland that we do bereavement so well. And we do have that deep, rich culture of saying to someone, I'm sorry for your loss. And I know what a great person this person was.
And I think it was beautiful, though, the way you said, to also remember the life they lived, the lovely life they lived.
And I really do believe this. We are more than the manner of our death.
Yeah.
You know, this old phrase, nothing became him like the manner of his leaving. No, actually, it's the manner of our living that becomes us. And the manner of our living includes living and loving and also building and making and hoping and all the built things, the hoped for things, the made things that everyone else input into, they all need to be celebrated and listened to. And the bereaved want to talk about those.
Well, Professor Jim Lucy, it was lovely to talk to you this morning. And I know you have a support group as well at stpatricks.ie. And I think you have a dedicated information and support line on 01-249-333.
And it's important to say that Pieta House does enormous work on this and has taken over a great deal of work from other bodies previously, and their links are on this website as well. And the blog I've written is an attempt to describe, because I think these things, we've been very good to give us time this morning to listen, to talk through this, and we were determined not to rush this, weren't we, Miriam? And it's been fantastic.
If but someone wants to read your blog now,
they should go onto the website at www.stpatricks.ie. It's
also
there at the moment.
I'm just going to give the number for the Samaritans out as well, just for someone listening to Jim, it's 01-671-0071. Jim Lucy, as ever.
Thanks very much, Miriam.
A privilege.
Today with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.